Well, we are here back in the book of Nehemiah for one last time in our series. And actually, this brings us to a conclusion of, I guess, about a year on and off of meditating on these books that give us the story of what God was doing in what we call the post-exilic period, the exilic and the post-exilic period, really the last stages of history that are recorded in the Old Testament for us. And we've come here to the end of it by God's grace in Nehemiah chapter 13, and we will be considering this morning from verse 4, where we left off last time, and all the way to the end. I'm sure that all of us are looking forward to the summer and perhaps making plans for getting away and having some fun and relaxation. Maybe some of you are planning a visit to an amusement park. And you might be looking forward to getting back on a roller coaster since so many of these places have been shut down for the last year. Where should you go if you really want to thrill as far as a roller coaster is concerned? That really is not my thing. More power to you if it is your thing. But I looked up what were some of the records as far as roller coasters are concerned. Quote, currently, the fastest roller coaster in the world, traveling at up to 149 miles per hour, is the Formula Rosa at Ferrari World Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. So the Americans are not at the top of the list for the fastest. The world's tallest, standing at 456 feet, is Kingda Ka at Six Flags Great Adventure in New Jersey. So we have the tallest right now. The world's longest is the Steel Dragon 2000 at Japan's Nagashima Spa Land amusement park in Nagashima, Kuwana, and it is over a mile and a half long. However, all three of those records, fastest, longest, tallest, are set to be broken in a couple of years in 2023. And that is because Six Flags Qiddiya is being built in a desert outside of Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. They've actually designated this segment of desert and have all kinds of plans going on to develop it into this exotic and extreme entertainment and sports complex, including this new Six Flags park. And the park is going to feature the roller coaster called Falcon's Flight. We're told that it will travel across approximately 2.5 miles of track at unprecedented speeds of about 155 miles per hour. The coaster will take riders over a vertical cliff and then dive into a 525 feet deep valley using magnetic motor acceleration. The ride will last about 3 minutes and host 20 riders at a time. So start saving. You got a couple years. You can travel to Saudi Arabia and have a lot of fun, apparently. Now, why am I bringing this up, this image of a roller coaster? I'm bringing it up because the experience of reading the Bible and the story of God's plan of redemption really is like riding a roller coaster. We talk here a lot about the redemptive storyline or the redemptive arc of Scripture and those great movements of creation, fall, redemption, and consummation that summarize the story of the Bible. And that is a great way to capture the essence of the Bible's message, but when we summarize it in that way, you certainly feel the weight and the shock and the disappointment of the fall, but to move right into redemption and consummation and knowing that everything's going to work out great in the end can make it seem like the trajectory after the fall is just a smooth and direct path to this high point and this climax. And I could maybe picture it like this. This might be what we visualize as the redemptive arc of Scripture: creation, fall, redemption, which at the heart of that is the cross and the resurrection of Christ, and then issuing in this victory at the very end in consummation. Folks, that is not the way the Bible reads. It is creation, fall, redemption, consummation. But the whole redemption part has been going on for thousands of years, and actually, it looks more like something like this. Or maybe this. Or maybe this. Or maybe all three of those put together is the experience of jolt and up and down, excitement, celebration, followed by disappointment, catastrophe, and it seems like it goes on and on, up and down in this roller coaster story. We witness some great advance in redemptive history. We are excited to see how the Lord is carrying out his work, and there is a great moment of victory, but then something unexpected happens, and now it seems like everything is lost, and we're starting all over. And the experience and the feeling you have, maybe if you read the Bible, leaves you looking something like this. Now, we see that pattern throughout the Scriptures, both Old and New Testaments, by the way. And we have seen it repeatedly as we have studied these final stages of Old Testament history in Ezra and Nehemiah. Let's just review a little bit where we have been during these months. We know that the people of Judah were stuck in Babylon, down at the bottom of a roller coaster for about 70 years, suffering God's judgment in the exile. And then the Lord brings on the throne a man by the name of Cyrus, who has a totally different approach to these conquered peoples, and God guides him to commission the Jews to return to Jerusalem and begin rebuilding. And over 40,000 of God's people make that trip back to Jerusalem under a man by the name of Zerubbabel, and they begin to rebuild the temple. They get as far as laying the foundation and rebuilding the altar, and very quickly they become overwhelmed and discouraged by the opposition that is mounting against them, and that project comes to a halt for about 16 years. Eventually, the Lord, through people like Haggai and Zechariah, urges them to get back to work, and the temple finally gets completed. And then Ezra comes on the scene with a second group of returnees. And as you're reading this upbeat story in the book of Ezra, we are thinking that revival is going to break out under his ministry. And then he discovers toward the end that there is this huge problem of a bunch of spiritually mixed marriages. And Ezra ends on a very low note, with all of these divorces of 100 and some Jewish men setting aside these pagan wives. It really was a very depressing note that book takes us to. We're down at the bottom of the roller coaster again. And then we open up the book of Nehemiah, the next segment of the story, and we learn that over a decade after what we learned in Ezra, Jerusalem's walls are still in ruins, and the city is sparsely populated. And God puts it on the heart of a man named Nehemiah to stick his neck out with the king at the time, Artaxerxes, and to seek permission to return to Jerusalem and help them with that part of the rebuilding the walls. And he ends up, by God's grace, overcoming all kinds of internal and external challenges as he organizes and leads the people in rebuilding the walls. And you remember, it only took them 52 days. It really was quite the climb up to the top of the roller coaster at that point. In just 52 days, and amid all kinds of challenges getting the job done. And then he and Ezra begin to give attention not so much to the physical condition of the people, but to their spiritual needs at this time. And they have this big Bible conference. Remember that? And all of this teaching of the Torah that went on, it affects the people deeply. They mourn over their sin. They confess their sin. They renew their covenant with the Lord. And they make a strong start of carrying out their responsibilities as the holy nation of Yahweh in this renewed covenant. That's actually been our focus the last few weeks. And what we have left in this book, after all of that, is verses 4 to 31 of Nehemiah 13. Get ready for a ride. We find here this very unexpected, sharp decline in the direction of these people. Now, Nehemiah served, best we can tell, he served as the governor of Judah for about 12 years, and we would say he was successful in what the Lord had laid on his heart, and then ended up returning to Persia. And verse 6 gives us a very important point about the setting of what we're looking at. If you would take a look at verse 6. He says, "While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king." And the passage goes on, "And after some time," we're not sure how long, it may have been as much as 10 years of time went by, "I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem." And probably at this time, this man's in his 60s. And, you know, normally the time you might think his life is winding down, he's retiring, or he can enjoy a little bit calmer situation and enjoy the fruit of his ministry. What he discovers when he goes back is that the effects of the revival had dissipated, and that a number of those very firm commitments that the people had made earlier, those commitments were being broken. And the book ends with Nehemiah almost having to start all over in the work of spiritual rebuilding, moving the Jews to obedience to the Lord and to his law. And it's just like we saw in Ezra, Nehemiah ends on a depressing note. And it leaves you, after all that you have seen, it leaves you disappointed. And I would say even skeptical about the spiritual prospects for the people of God. From a literary standpoint, we have a word for this kind of development and this kind of ending. And the definition is as follows: a descent in power, quality, dignity, etc., a disappointing, weak, or inglorious conclusion. And that's the definition of our word anticlimax. And so our theme this morning is the anticlimax of spiritual decline. That's not a very exciting title for a sermon, but it is, I think, an accurate reflection of how this book comes to a close, the anticlimax of spiritual decline. And I'm going to approach it a little bit differently this morning. First, I'm going to walk us through the passage and try to limit my comments as we read the different elements here. We're going to survey the decline, and then we're going to come back and look at it all together and draw some lessons from all of this decline. So first of all, let's survey the passage and get a sense of what's happening here and why this is such an anticlimax. And I want to begin by explaining one point right there at the beginning of verse 4, where it says, "Now before this, Eliashib the priest," etc., etc. That little expression, "now before this," what is that referring to? Initially, you might say, well, that's looking back in the passage, and it is referring to what has just been recorded. But if you remember what we covered last week, that would create some confusing chronological problems, because what had just been recorded seems to be what all went on at the time when the walls were dedicated. And it was a good bit before the events were getting ready to read here. And things would seem to be out of order chronologically. So what is going on here? Well, the word this, before this, instead of pointing backward, could actually be pointing forward to the events we're about ready to consider. And you might paraphrase it this way: now before this next development, specifically of me going over, being in Persia and going back to Jerusalem. However, that exact expression translated "now before this," it's the only place that it occurs in all the Old Testament, and it may not be a time reference at all. Literally, this could be translated "now to the face of this," or we might say "now in the face of this," that is, in the face of everything that was just recorded of how well things were going. And despite all of the commitments and all of the spiritual decisions and implementations that went on in those passages, despite all the spiritual progress made in the passages we've considered, what happens? Well, what happens is this decline, and there are four kinds of decline. The first of those is in verses 4 to 9, in what I'm calling here, worship corrupted. Worship corrupted. So let's read these verses. "Now before this," or "now in the face of this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, and who was related to Tobiah, prepared for Tobiah a large chamber where they had previously put the grain offering, the frankincense, the vessels, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priests. While this was taking place, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went to the king. And after some time, I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem, and I then discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, preparing for him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And I was very angry, and I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of his chamber. Then I gave orders, and they cleansed the chambers, and I brought back there the vessels of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense." Maybe that gives you a little sense of the disappointment that Nehemiah feels as he realizes what has been happening in his absence. And you might remember that one of the great commitments of chapter 10 was that the people were going to give financially to support those who were working at the temple, whether it be the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers. It was a pretty complicated operation, and this was not like just showing up to church for a few hours on Sunday. This thing was operational for different events and sacrifices all week long. It required a large staff. They required support if they were to dedicate themselves fully to that work, and so they knew they needed to support them financially, and they made that commitment. And they set aside storerooms to keep those things that were brought as tithes and offerings, and they made arrangements so that that material would be distributed fairly and consistently to the servants of God. In fact, that chapter, that's really what happens at the very end of chapter 10, is the emphasis on giving. And the last line of chapter 10, these people say, "We will not neglect the house of our God." That's what they promise. We're not going to neglect the house of God. We also read at the beginning of chapter 13, we covered this last week, that out of obedience to a command in Deuteronomy 23, the people decided they were going to exclude all the Ammonites from the assembly of God's people and those who had access to worship the Lord at the temple. And so you have two things that are at the background of this. They're very good decisions. First of all, we're going to give to support the people, the servants of God. Number two, we're going to exclude these other people, these pagans that have been our enemies, out of obedience to God's command. And now Nehemiah finds both of those have been overturned. One of the temple storerooms is vacated of what had been being collected, and it is then set up as living quarters for this man Tobiah, who happens to be an Ammonite. Not only that, but earlier in the book, we have read a lot about Tobiah. He is one of the great enemies of Nehemiah when he was trying to rebuild the wall. And he tried to stop the rebuilding project and to destroy Nehemiah in a number of ways. The Lord frustrated all those efforts, but still Nehemiah had what we might call an inside track into the people of God because of a family relationship with one of the priests, Eliashib. Presumably there had been some intermarriage that created this kind of relationship and this kind of compromise, really, or a way by which this other influence could start to have a part among the people of God. And he uses that relationship to gain access to the temple. In fact, he may have been using it also to profit materially by selling himself items that were needed by the servants of God or by the people wanting to worship there. And Nehemiah finds this out, and he will have none of this, and he immediately evicts Tobiah and has all his stuff thrown out. I like to picture this in my mind, this rush eviction and the zeal with which Nehemiah handles these things. You say, why was he so concerned about a guy just kind of hanging out, making his own little parsonage right there in the temple precincts? Well, notice how he puts it in verse 4 that this was an issue having to do with the house of our God. And also verse 9, again, this is about the house of God. This is no way to be treating the house of God. The Lord has given us the privilege of establishing his own personal residence here in the middle of our city. And we are in holy covenant with this holy God, and we have this place set aside for holy worship. We cannot allow this, special as it is, privilege as it is, we cannot allow this to become corrupted by pagan elements or these pagan people using this to infiltrate, to push their agendas, and ultimately to damage us and to move us away from the worship of God. He was so serious about it because the worship had been corrupted. Secondly, verses 10 to 14, service neglected. Service neglected. Let's read starting at verse 10. I also found out that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who did the work had fled, each to his field. So I confronted the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their stations. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses, and I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Padiah of the Levites, and as their assistant, Hanan, the son of Zakur, son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and their duty was to distribute to their brothers. And then this closing prayer. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of God, the house of my God, and for his service. Here we learn what we might have suspected from the other passage, that in the longer term, the time that's passed since the great revival, The people did not follow through with their promise to support the temple workers. And it got to be so bad that these people had to do something to support themselves. And so they have to leave their responsibilities and go away from the city to work their own fields in order to provide for themselves, to feed themselves, and to feed their families. And this is part of what had happened that had led to a decline in the glory and the beauty of what was supposed to be happening there in worship. Nehemiah steps in and he fixes that problem as well. He renews the tithing. He makes sure that it is managed and it is administered honestly by putting in positions of influence people that could be trusted to carry out that responsibility. And his motivation is the same as it was when he kicked Tobiah out of that storeroom. Verse 11, why is the house of God forsaken or neglected? This is no way to honor the God that you're supposedly worshiping by just letting it go whatever, and we just kind of hope for the best, but we're not providing for its continuation. Why is the house of God forsaken? And then he says, verse 14, my good deeds that I have done for the house of God and for his service. And we have seen that kind of God-centered motivation again and again in Nehemiah's life. And so he works to address this second problem of service neglected. Number three, decline. I could put it in the terms of distinctiveness abandoned. That is, the distinctiveness of God's people and their worship and even their regular weekly routine of the Sabbath. Look at verse 15. In those days I saw in Judah people treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys, and also wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them on the day when they sold food. Tyrians also who lived in the city brought in fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the people of Judah in Jerusalem itself. Then I confronted the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing that you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers act in this way? Did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Now you are bringing more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. As soon as it began to grow dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and gave orders that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I stationed some of my servants at the gates that no load might be brought in on the Sabbath day. Then the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, but I warned them and said to them, why do you lodge outside the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come and guard the gates to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember this also in my favor, O my God, and spare me according to the greatness of your steadfast love. Here again, what's happening there is in direct violation of the commitment that they had made in chapter 10. Because in verse 31 of that chapter, they had declared this, and if the peoples of the land bring in goods or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. And that was the top of the roller coaster. And it sounded great, and for a while some of them did follow that. And now we're at the bottom, on the way down, the sharp decline. At this point, the Sabbath has gone by the wayside also. And by doing business on the Sabbath, what was supposed to be a unique day of rest, a special day of worship, had been turned largely into a day like any other day on the calendar. This was no small matter in light of the terms of the Old Covenant. Exodus 31 had said that the Sabbath was a sign of the special relationship that Israel had with the Creator of all things. Deuteronomy 5 had actually called the Sabbath a covenant or a way by which they remembered their distinctiveness of being in covenant with God. They were delivered from slavery. They didn't have to work this degrading and oppressive way. God gave them a day off to remember the action of being delivered from that situation and the special covenant relationship. Breaking the covenant in the Sabbath was diminishing the uniqueness of Israel as a nation, just kind of turning every day into the same, just like everybody else. It's the sort of feeling you get when here we are gathered celebrating the Lord's Day, and people sometimes, even in church, treat it like it's any other place. Texting, going online, carrying on, this kind of thing, what does it do? It treats it like this is not special, like this is not a moment set aside to focus our attention on the purposes and the works of God. And it was a very demoralizing thing to Nehemiah, just like it's a demoralizing thing to us as we try to give special time to the Lord. Nehemiah firmly addresses the problem. And this passage, as we read, it goes into some depth. He stops the commerce. He closes the city gates. He sets up guards. He threatens the sellers that they better not come back. He's going to do whatever it takes to enforce God's law and to uphold the distinctiveness of the people of God and their worship. Their distinctiveness has been abandoned at this point. And then there's the final passage, which I summarize in terms of purity compromised. Purity compromised, verses 23 to 31. In those days also I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. Some of our parents can relate to the desire to do that. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves." Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore, I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleansed them from everything foreign, and I established the duties of the priest and Levites, each in his work, and I provided for the wood offering at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. End of the book of Nehemiah. I would call that anticlimax. And here is yet another one of those commitments in chapter 10 that they violated. They had said in 10:31, "We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons." And as I've said repeatedly, that decision was not about ethnic cleansing or a sense of ethnic superiority. It was following through with the desires of God laid out in the Torah about maintaining the spiritual purity of God's people by marrying only those who were worshipers of the one true and living God. Well, so much for that. at this point. And these verses really are a repetition of the final verses of Ezra. They are all about the Jewish people marrying pagans. And it brings about the severest of the reactions of Nehemiah in this chapter. He says, I confronted them, and I cursed them, and beat some of them, and pulled out their hair. Does that sound over the top? Well, actually, in the Old Testament, the law did allow for some level of physical punishment by civil authorities. And we have examples of where even leaders of God's people are pronouncing a curse in the sense of God's judgment on those who have apostatized or rebelled against him. But actually, the passage that to me comes to mind is this one. In the temple, Jesus found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. That sounds just like what we're reading as far as the passion of Nehemiah for the purity of the worship of God and his intensity about dealing with this kind of corruption. And then he finds that it isn't just the people generally who had married idol worshipers, it was actually some of the priests as well. In fact, a man from the line of the high priest had married a daughter of Sanballat. And you should recognize that name as well because he was with Tobiah, one of the main instigators of the opposition toward Nehemiah. You want to talk about something over the top? That's over the top. This level of intermarriage where even the priesthood were involved. And yet again, we see Nehemiah doing the difficult thing as he confronts this very personal issue of marriage. And out of his devotion for the purity of God's people, he doesn't go as far as Ezra did in terms of requiring a divorce, but going forward, he makes the people take an oath that this is not going to happen again. And if you think that maybe these were kind of exceptions to what the people of God generally were doing through this period and things were, for the most part, okay, you've got these few things here that Nehemiah encounters, read the last book of the Old Testament. And its name is Malachi. And he ministered during this same period. And he is dealing with some of these same issues in very strong terms and urging the people to repent. And the book of Nehemiah ends on that abrupt note. The Jews have grossly violated the law of God and even their own commitments. And Nehemiah is boldly rebuking and correcting them. The roller coaster has careened hundreds of feet. And it is left stuck at the bottom with this final prayer, Lord, remember me. But everybody else, what a devastated condition. And we read that, and other than being kind of depressed, what are we supposed to take away from this chapter and really this whole book? Well, that's what I want to end on. We have surveyed the decline, and now let's see what we can learn from it. I leave you with three categories in which we ought to be learning from the story of Nehemiah. First of all, we learn a lot here concerning human nature. Human nature. You remember that song that says, "Prone to wonder, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love." That's what I'm talking about when I say learning about human nature. First of all, that you and I are prone to drift. In this case, when the pressure of Nehemiah's very strong leadership was gone, eventually the people wandered off into disobedience and the very things that they had said they were not going to do. And I've been talking about roller coasters. Roller coasters work with gravity, right? There is this force that is pulling us downward. You're not conscious of it, but you will feel it if you get too close to the edge of a cliff. There is this force, unfelt but real. That's a law, we call it. And it's moving downward all the time. Well, you and I are constantly exposed to and pulled along by forces that at the time we may not feel, but that nevertheless are real and powerful, the downward pull of the world, the flesh, and the devil, and particularly as we're talking here about human nature, our own sinful flesh is continuously pulling us along away from the Lord. A book like Nehemiah is very honest with us about that. It is here to warn us about that. It is here to encourage a proper self-evaluation and a repentance and a regular fleeing to God for grace, lest I should fall down the cliff myself. We are prone to drift. And a little more specifically, you and I are prone to compromise. So much of this had to do with illicit relationships and people that they were supposed to have a certain distance from as far as marriage or even commerce and religious kinds of associations as well. And it was particularly through those kinds of relationships that they end up being pulled even further away from the Lord. And with us as well, we tend to love human relationships and sort of default to human relationships sometimes more than we love our own relationship with God. And out of wanting to be with people that we enjoy, and out of enjoying certain things they do for us, and out of feeling loved by them, we will often set aside the more important issue of our relationship with the Lord and the commitments that we have made to Him through Christ. We are prone to compromise. And number three, we are also prone to forget. Did you pick this up in Nehemiah's words a couple of times? Verse 18, did not our fathers act in this very way about the Sabbath? And look at what has happened as a result. Look at all this catastrophe that came. Did you forget, like, what happened over the last 100 years? Like, are you so blind? Don't you see where this leads? Are you that naive? You don't have to be a great student of history. This is kind of obvious. And then it comes to the issue of the intermarriages with the heathen. And he says, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Did you learn nothing from the exile and all that your parents have told you and everything the Bible records? And so this book is pleading with us. It is pleading with us. This is serious business. It is pleading with us to learn from history, lest we end up in these very same places. It is pleading with us to take seriously the warnings about obedience and worship and purity and relationships. And so we learn about our nature. Secondly, we learn as well about spiritual leadership. And in the general theme statement for Nehemiah, I brought that out, that the restoration, as far as it got in this phase, was largely through one or two key men that the Lord raised up and that demonstrated the kind of zeal that Nehemiah has demonstrated. What do we learn about spiritual leadership in this chapter and really throughout the whole book? First of all, that leadership is necessary. And it reinforces what has been clear throughout all Israel's history. You can think back on the history of the nation as a whole, and what generally stands out is a handful of key individuals, right? Abraham, Moses, David, Elijah, Elisha. What stands out and how God generally kept it somewhat from destruction, right, was through a few people that sensed his call, that yielded to him, that paid the price, and that by his grace made a difference. Can you imagine? I mean, for as bad as things were when Nehemiah was gone for just a few years there, for as bad as they were in this chapter, I mean, how bad would it have been if there were no Ezra and there were no Nehemiah? It really highlights the value of just one individual who's willing to follow the call of God and take the position that he needs to take and seek to have an influence. But what is that kind of person signing up for? Leadership is not only necessary, but this book is very honest that leadership is hard. This is not an easy life that you're signing up for. There is a price to be paid. And in the case of Nehemiah, one of the things I walk away with, I've thought about this before regarding being a leader, whether it's in the home or in your work or in society or in the church, whatever, a lot of leadership is simply about telling people things they would rather not hear. And being the spokesman who's willing to just be straightforward and saying, this does not please God. This is false. This is true. Nehemiah was willing to be plain spoken like that. And just like him, when you do that, you can expect opposition. Sometimes from God's own people, sometimes from outside of the people of God. People are not readily going to accept that. Last couple of weeks, I've talked about revival some, and I have quoted a little bit about the third Great Awakening and then the second Great Awakening. And of course, that would imply there's a first Great Awakening. And Nehemiah's ministry has been compared to the kind of thing that happened to one of the great leaders of the first Great Awakening, and his name was Jonathan Edwards. And we think of him in terms of revival and sinners in the hands of an angry God and the religious affections and this mighty movement of God in this country in the early to mid-1700s. And yet, for all of the revival that Jonathan Edwards encouraged and witnessed, I don't know if you know the story, his life ended really quite sadly. And particularly the fact that he was kicked out of his church in Northampton, Massachusetts, after 23 years of ministry there, where they had seen so much revival. And of all things, it happened just because he says, you know what, I think that in order for people to take the Lord's Supper, they ought to have a credible profession of faith. That really was the issue. And they wouldn't have that because of bad teaching in the past, actually by his own grandfather. But that's what happened, and I quote for you now, from the farewell sermon that he preached to those people when he was dismissed. Quote, "The contentions which have been among you since I first became your pastor have been one of the greatest burdens I have labored on in the course of my ministry. Not only the contentions you've had with me, but which you have had with one another about your lands and other concerns, because I knew that contention, heat of spirit, evil speaking, and things of the like nature were directly contrary to the spirit of Christianity and did in a peculiar manner tend to drive God's spirit from a people." Yikes. That's your farewell sermon. That's what Nehemiah faced. That is the kind of straightforwardness that he is addressing to them in the face of their own opposition. Leadership is hard. How would you carry out your calling anyway? Leadership requires God-oriented courage. Now, I've been talking about roller coaster and decline and anti-climax, but in reality, those words do not apply to the leadership of Nehemiah himself in this moment. This man remained consistent and strong to the bitter end. He was faithful, and it was all oriented to God and to God's glory. He has demonstrated throughout this book a burden for the reputation of Yahweh among the nations. He's always addressing the Lord in prayer. In the moment of need and crisis, asking for strength and wisdom. And even in the text that we read today, his heart goes up to the Lord, asking for God to vindicate him and not let him get swept up in all the judgment that he expects might happen, and to reward him for his faithfulness. This man could pray those kinds of prayers in good conscience because he had consistently followed the Lord and been faithful to his calling. And these things are there as an example for us, particularly in leadership. And then finally, learning about the bigger scheme or the bigger picture of divine redemption. Here are some of my takeaways about God's redemptive plan. First of all, I'm just blown away that God put up with this. That after everything that happened in the Old Testament, he continues to work with these people through somebody like Nehemiah. God's patience is amazing. And if we learn nothing else from this, we ought to just be humbled and thankful for the Lord and his ongoing perseverance with us. No doubt if it had been you or me, we would have given up on Israel a long time ago. Number two, God's patience is amazing, but God's Messiah is the only solution to the kind of problems that we see happen again and again in Nehemiah. For as great of a leader as this man was, he, humanly speaking, was not very successful in the end. And it wasn't his fault. It was just that he could only go so far. He could not actually fix people at the deep level that they needed to be fixed in order for these problems to really be resolved. And Christ comes in. I believe that Nehemiah's leadership and yet his inability to ultimately fix these problems points ahead to the kind of Messiah that the entire Old Testament has been pointing to. Let me read you these observations. Christ is the perfect king who, unlike Nehemiah, can transform people's hearts as well as their behavior. Number two, Christ is the perfect priest who is sinless and so can serve successfully as the mediator between God and man. Number four, Christ is the ultimate temple that cannot be corrupted by human error. He presents himself in the New Testament as the temple where God and man unite in unhindered fellowship. And all this about the temple has been pointing ahead to communion with God through Christ. For as great as we see Nehemiah's life, let us see as well his inabilities, pointing us to Christ as the ultimate king and priest and temple. And I do challenge you with the question, have you received Christ as your king? Have you relied upon him personally as your priest? Not like so many of these people, just kind of a part of a group. And just because we go to the same place or sing the same songs, we assume everything's okay. That's not going to be sufficient. Your own personal relationship by faith with Jesus for yourself. And yet, even under the new covenant, those of us who have embraced Christ, his work, for as wonderful it is in this age, is not complete. And when you read Nehemiah, you can't avoid thinking of your own life and that your own sanctification and the condition of the Church of Christ at large looks too much like the roller coaster. We really ought to be further ahead at this point. But our sanctification is too much like that roller coaster. And when that is frustrating to us, we come to this last thought about divine redemption, that God's coming kingdom is our ultimate hope. We are, in a sense, already in the kingdom, enjoying some of its benefits, but we are not yet there in its fullness, not by a stretch. And one writer said this about Nehemiah: it is as if "to be continued" has been written at the end of the work. And in reality, that is true of the whole Bible. It applies to the New Testament as well. To be continued. And in the book of Revelation, we get this trailer of the final installment of this story. "And I saw the holy city," finally holy like it was supposed to be, "New Jerusalem, coming not out of the ground and walls, but coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. Even so, come, Lord Jesus.'"